Kat.
And I'm Kurt, and you're listening to Kat and Kurt's TV Review.
Welcome to episode 256, Self-Esteem is for Everybody. This week we're discussing episode 6 of Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, The Black Tower, and season 5, episode 14 of Angel, Smile Time.
As always, we suggest you watch the episodes before you listen to the podcast. Also, if you haven't done so already, you may want to listen to our first podcast to get an idea of our methodology. All right. JSMN.
JSMN.
The penultimate episode here of the series. Yeah. So I want to kind of start off where the episode starts, which is with Norrell getting his copy of Strange's book,
mm-hmm.
And then proceeding to make it, along with many others, disappear. Actually, does he make his own copy disappear?
That's a good question.
Now that I say that, because, like, I could totally see him being the kind of guy
who keeps the only copy.
In fact, he very much is the one buying up all the other copies of all the other magic.
Right.
So I could totally see him. It's okay for him to have a copy.
Yes.
Just not everybody.
Yes, right, for their own protection. But he can be the guardian right. of, like, he doesn't want, I could see him in a weird way convincing himself that, like, this way it's not actually destroying the book. It still exists, the knowledge isn't gone, he hasn't really, like, destroyed it, but
right.
but we'll only keep it in the one library that can be trusted with this kind of information.
Sure, exactly. Right. So, yeah, so I'm not entirely clear what is going on there, but it does seem he certainly destroys everyone else's.
Yeah.
Or causes them to disappear anyway.
Yeah.
I don't know if destroys is quite the right word either.
Right.
Because we don't know what actually happens
to them. No.
All right.
No, well, they're vanished at least.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I guess part of the reason, other than just that being a very Norrell move to kind of keep and hoard the magical book, even just the way that he, before he sort of vanishes them, sort of opens it and lovingly kind of caresses it and
like thumbs through
reads
it,
yeah. it and weeps over its beauty and this, you know, the lost potential of this, of their relationship and like all this stuff, like before he then proceeds to get rid of
all the feels.
He has all the yeah. feels about this book. So like, it's hard to imagine that he destroyed it utterly, you know, like I feel like he recognizes that it has power and significance. And so it's a question of it not being available to everybody else, but he might still want it available to him.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we know that he's had other books in his library that he considers too dangerous for even Strange to look
mm-hmm.
at. So, yeah, I could totally see him disappearing everybody else's book, but not his copy. Speaking of Strange, he's in Venice,
mm-hmm.
Trying to become mad.
As you do.
Yeah. As one, what does that say about Venetians? Like, is that
sure.
the reason he goes to Venice? Like,
sure.
Of the places you could go mad, that's like the best, that's at the top of the list, maybe?
Well, there's this allusion to the romantic poets in this episode, right? Like, this is where all of, you know,
sure.
Byron and Keats and those guys are all sort of gallivanting off to Italy and Geneva and all these places to snort opium and have ecstatic visions and kind of lead their debauched lifestyles and everything. But I guess that's kind of the connection, right? I mean, other than the fact that he just is fleeing the country as a fugitive, he needs to go somewhere in Europe.
Right.
But like, there's a connection to the his contemporaries at that time. And I guess this Italians are, I guess, meant to be a bit more passionate than the restrained English people. So maybe this is seen as a place to go and get in touch with your kind of inhibitions and your spiritual side and everything.
Sure. I also feel like I may be misremembering. Is it Polidori's vampire story that takes place at least partially in Venice or somewhere in Italy?
Does it? Maybe. I don't remember, but that's nothing could be likelier.
Maybe I'm misremembering, but anyway. I feel like of an Italian, like if you're going to pick an Italian setting, Venice is of course like maybe a good one because it is kind of like romantic and organic in the way that it's sort of like its streets kind of like wind around where the buildings have cropped up and, you know, or vice versa. Maybe I don't like, it's certainly not a regular, you know, city by like, I mean, and old like European cities are not exactly, they're not like Manhattan grid, you know, at all to begin with. But like Venice is even more so because it's like water and erosion and, you know, stones kind of wherever you can figure out how to prop them up and all of that kind of stuff.
Right. The whole thing might sort of topple into the sea at any moment. Like there's, it's kind of a dangerous, kind of, precarious place to be.
Yes, yeah, it's already sort of like defying logic and reason just by its very existence as a city.
Yeah.
Whether any of that's true, it sounds good. So he's in Venice actively trying to go mad. And like, you have to wonder, like, I mean, he's a magician, and so he's to a certain extent following recipes, I guess, and like, you know, making in his like sort of potion making and whatever it is that he's, I mean, I assume these are meant to be like some kind of magic potions, not, which is sort of the first time we see him doing any kind of potion work, right? Like before it's always been more of like the, not showy, but more like the, I don't know, kinetic magic. Is that like a thing? Like it's like the, you know, put your hands in the ground and cause the horse sand to rise up, you know, like wave your arms around and point at the vine and it, you know, grows or whatever.
Right.
Like this is definitely along the lines of the more chemistry kind of magic that we see like Willow doing in season two or so of Buffy, or like in Harry Potter or whatever, like the potions class.
Right, where it's about like assembled ingredients and, you know, the right mix of elements boiled at a certain length of time, and you kind of, when you put them together in just the right way, sort of weird things kind of, and I guess again, like if we're connecting it to the they mention in here again, the romantic poets and their chemical experiments and everything, it kind of like is fitting that like at the same time he's in there doing something with potions, and like it sort of mirrors those sorts of, you know, narcotic experiments and everything.
Sure. And it does have that sort of natural philosophy kind of aspect to it, right? Like of the, of that, like you're talking about, like with the experimentation. And I was, even as I was saying that, I was just kind of thinking back to, is it the very first scene of the show of Segundus? It's not a potion, but it did seem more like that recipe kind of magic, like where it was like pulling together the right items and ingredients rather than, so I guess we do see some of it before, but obviously Segundus is not successful.
Sure.
Right. Cause isn't that, that's a moment where we get like the maids kind of like watching him through the slits in the wall or whatever.
Yeah, and maybe not quite as wild and out of control as Jonathan's house has become, but like, if I remember right, it's like a similar sort of setup in the house where you have all sorts of weird things hanging from the walls mm-hmm. and the rafters, like different bits of like animals and dead flowers and, you know, I don't know, herbs and like different things that he might use for his potion making. So it yeah. kind of gives that same feeling of like, this is like a witch's hut, you know, who's going to like brew something terrible.
And so whatever it is seems not to be working too well for Strange. At least he's far more reasonable still than he is mad.
Well, can you make yourself go mad? Is that a thing that can be willed? I don't know. Like,
that's a good question.
That's a.
I mean, that's what he's that's a certainly
conundrum of this episode. Yeah.
On the course to set out, mm-hmm. and I guess the question is: does he succeed, or does it happen despite his attempts?
Sure.
And so he goes to this Venetian merchant, and apparently he doesn't know Italian. Right, which is like
great start.
Yeah, maybe you should have gone somewhere where you can speak the language. Although maybe he doesn't know any other language than English, which okay, so be it. Yeah, so he goes to his merchant who apparently he's been buying items from, and so he goes and tries to get more of, do we know what it is? Is it like mercury or something?
Oh, I don't remember. Something unsavory.
And the merchant, of course, is like, no, no, it'll make you go mad or kill you. And he's like, yes, go mad. That's what I want.
Yes, yes, that's what I want.
it reminds me of, in Ghostbusters where, he asks if he wants coffee. Should I have some coffee? Yes, have some. Yes, have some. Anyway.
Well, it's also a little bit of Lady Pole from last week, too. Of like, should we write to Mr. Strange? Yes.
Yes, please.
That's exactly what I've been asking for.
I've literally been saying that. And in order to deal with the merchant, he fortuitously happens upon the Grey Steels. Young Miss Graysteel's name is escaping me at the moment.
Flora,
thank you. What a juxtaposition of names.
Mm. Yeah.
Flora does not like make me think Graysteel.
Sound like a Graysteel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course, you can't say Graysteel without thinking Greyjoy from Game of Thrones.
She wouldn't fit in with them either.
I suppose you could, but I don't. I didn't. I was like, oh.
Hmm. Right.
Yeah, I didn't think of that. Probably because I could never quite remember her first name. But when you just said that, yeah, Flora Graysteel. Hmm. Like, it's a very, evokes two very different images.
Yeah, you're right. I never really thought about that either. Huh. And I guess,
anyway.
I mean, there's a divide between Flora and Dr. Graysteel. Like, even though she's his daughter, they're from the same family. Like, they don't necessarily see eye to eye. So I guess maybe it kind of reflects her sort of rebellion against what her family would approve.
Although, I mean, presumably her parents named her.
Sure, yes. Yes, but like,
and
I guess
Flora,
more from the symbolic point of view, not the why did her parents literally name her that point of view.
Yeah. I mean, Flora is a Latinate name, which I guess, I mean, could be an English name. Like, I certainly I'm sure there are English women who have been named Flora, but it doesn't sound English.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it sounds much closer to Italian or Latin or whatever than
mm-hmm.
than English, than an English name would. Now Florence, maybe, but even that's, I mean, there's literally a city in
there called Florence. Yes.
So like, even as I said that, I was just like, maybe not.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, again, I don't mean to imply that like English women aren't named Flora, but like, it doesn't sound like a solidly English name. Like, you know, it certainly sounds a little more, maybe we don't know much about the Graciosa. Is her mother Italian, perhaps? I don't know.
Maybe. Yeah, we don't know. And we don't really know what the, other than going to visit the cat lady, we don't really even hear too much about what their background is. Like, why are they here? How long have they been here? Like, you know, there's a story there that we're not, I don't think, certainly not in this episode, I don't think we get the details about that. I can't remember if we do. We probably get more in the book, although I don't remember it all. But yeah, it's kind of just, well, in the show, it's sort of intriguing that you're not really, other than these vague hints about this scandal that she had kind of run off with Byron, you know, and.
But who has?
But join the club, right? But like,
I mean, that's.
Other than that, and I guess like a vague sense that maybe Dr. Graysteel would rather they like go back to sensible England and everything, like, I don't think we get a lot of backstory for them in the show.
So I suppose that would be why she was there, and then Dr. Graysteel is maybe there to collect her.
Sure, like maybe this is recently and he's come to get her. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so, right, and there's that implication of, like, oh, now she's attracted to this magician who is actively trying to go mad. And oh, by the way, we find out, is a fugitive from justice. and she certainly seems like, oh, and you're a widower. Yeah, like, well, he clearly needs a woman to look after him. Which is, of course, what Arabella says, right? Like, that she seems to be looking after him more than the other way around.
Right, right.
I mean, it seems to me to be kind of clear, although I'm not sure how much I'm reading into. Like, I feel like in the book, we get more of the sense that there's, if not a courtship, at least a potential for a courtship here, that like there's very much a sense in, at least from her perspective, and maybe I'm totally misremembering, but that maybe there's a sense that like this is a potential husband, you know, or at least, you know, there's some kind of romantic attachment there.
Yeah.
And his magicianness is certainly not, he's not a poet, but it's certainly not the norm either. So there's like plenty of room there for maybe the strange, because she seems, I mean, even in this episode, she seems very intrigued by the notion of his magic. And even to the point of like asking pointed questions of like, well, what's your, you know, to what object is your, you know, study trying to lead? You know, maybe it, you know, it's hard because like she doesn't express precisely her own thoughts or intentions per se, but you know, you could easily read into that like it, like how much is that interest in magic as a subject and how much is it interest in Mr. Strange as a single man? Like, and that's not to say it can't be both. And I certainly would assume that it is both. Like, I think they do kind of go hand in hand.
Right,
in
right.
Too. Yeah, and maybe I'm misremembering that, but I do seem to recall that in the book we get maybe a little more of that sense that, and I think the time span is also longer, so you get more of a sense that, like, there's some kind of relationship developing between them. Now, that's not to say, I mean, Jonathan is always focused on, you know, reviving his wife, so I don't necessarily think that it's the same in both ways, but there also might be a sense of, on her part, like, well, if he doesn't succeed in reviving his wife, then there should be someone here to help him out, you know, the meantime.
Yeah, I think you're probably right, and probably because it does sort of take place over months or however
it's
long.
Like months, that
they're sort of acquainted and, you know, she's helping him with stuff and everything. So, yeah, maybe that sense of her being actively kind of, you know, I don't know if pursuing him is too strong a term, but kind of at least being available.
Right.
In case he might.
You're here, I'm here, let's hang out.
In case he might change his mind.
But also, like, again, we don't get her sort of explicitly stating, so I'm trying not to be too cryptic about it. You know, but there is a sense that she is also just, she's providing him a service, but getting something in return, which is, you know, her answers about magic.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, interest in sort of the topic.
Yeah, yeah, and I think it definitely is both, like, her interest in his profession is also there, and that's, I think, why she's interested in people like him. Is it's not just that he's single, it's if she's kind of going for, if she has a type, it's like she's intrigued by the work that they do and the kind of mysticism behind it and everything. So I don't think she wouldn't necessarily even be interested in him if it wasn't for all of his magic and his wildness and his, you know, his his mad side and all that sort of thing. So, yeah, like, in the show, I don't get the sense that she's pushing him necessarily to, like, kind of reciprocate anything. But then you do get the little glimpses every so often about, like, will, you know, when this is all done, will you teach me magic? And there's that really chilling moment when he's talking about the Raven King, and maybe he's, you know, just an idea. And then she goes, "You must take me dancing." You know, that kind of, like, that's not a great sign. But there's something about that conversation, like, you know, that sort of, I don't know, stirs something up in her that, you know, that she kind of latches onto, and with a very creepy idea.
Yeah. Right. And yeah, you almost wonder if the gentleman sees them together, would he suddenly have a new, you know,
dancing, did you say? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So yeah. All right. There's another woman in Strange's life, in Venice, and it's Mrs. Delgado, which, of course, so in Spanish, gato is cat. Is Delgado, like, derived from some sort of Italian version of cat?
Let's find out.
Yeah, I'm typing it into Google as we. Apparently it means, like, thin or slender. I don't know. I feel like it's too close to, like.
Or at least it's meant to kind of evoke the sound of a cat, even if the literal meaning isn't the same. You know, like, maybe just from a purely, you know, sound point of view, it it sort of evokes Mrs. Delgado surrounded by her cats, you know?
Yeah. Well, in Italian, gatto is also cat. There's an extra T in Italian, but it's the same word.
Right.
So, maybe that is how it's spelled. Is it D-E-L? How did you spell it?
I did it with a D, but only because that's the name that I know. But I could have spelled it wrong.
Yeah. I wonder if maybe Del, D-E-L-G-A-T-T-O is... also, anyway, yeah, we probably should have done this research before.
No, it's with a D. It's Mrs. Delgado.
Oh, it is.
Yeah, in I the... just looked it up. But I think the point stands. I wouldn't be surprised if the name was chosen to sound like the right. kind of romance languages, you know, their words for cat. Yeah. And I mean, let's just acknowledge one of the great crazy cat ladies of literature here. You know, if you're gonna do a crazy cat lady when you're doing a book about madness, you might as well go all the way, and she certainly does.
She does. Yeah, right. So, I mean, there's the rat thing.
Mm-hmm.
In that she eats them.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and
it gets, like, I don't want to speak for all the cat people out there, but it sort of...
Of which you are one.
But, so I'll speak for myself. I like this kind of, like, almost the way he sort of looks for the underlying logic or desire that kind of... So it's not just you're mad because you have a chemical imbalance or because... You know what I mean? Like, it seems like he has to... In order to become mad and learn how to be mad, he has to find the core of... There's some sort of underlying reason why she's mad in this particular way. And it kind of boils down to this thing of she wants to be a cat. Like, she surrounds herself with cats and lives like them because that's her kind of greatest wish is,
sure.
is to turn into and live among them. And that's sort of, he grants her that wish. That's the kind of the bargain that they make in a very kind of... I don't know, gentleman-like way, he sort of offers her a trade. They kind of exchange...
I didn't think of it that way, but yeah, it is a very sort of fairy deal.
Yeah, right? Yeah, like you give me something and I'll give you something, and, you know. So, yeah, she kind of gives him the secret of her madness, and then she's sort of able to finally... get what it is that's driving her crazy, that, you know, with longing. So it's just sort of really being a cat person myself, I find this whole thing pretty funny.
Yeah, just let me know before you turn into a cat so I can find another
podcast partner. Yeah.
Yeah. That's all I ask.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so, yeah, he kind of helps her out, and she helps him out. It is kind of funny, though, to think of the concept of your madness having, like, a logical reason behind it. You know, like, it is almost that, like, well, isn't a mad person just mad? Like, isn't there, I mean, yeah, today we might call it an imbalance or, you know, some kind of, you know, maybe mental trauma or, you know, like that there, I guess there's still like ways to sort of reason out why someone is mad, but that kind of defies the point of madness, which is just that there is no reason, that there's no underlying, like almost, there's almost a sense in which like the scientific explanations that we have, or insofar as we have any scientific explanation, it almost goes against that whole idea of people being mad to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. In the meantime, meanwhile, back in England, we have this sort of plot developing between, I don't know if plot's quite the right word, I guess it is, between Norrell, Pole, Lascelles, and the rest.
the professor and Marion.
Yeah, well, Childermass, which is he. The professor and Childermass. Yeah, that works. Childermass is Marion. That's a odd thing to think. Yeah, trying to find, you know, trying to figure out where Norrell is, or where Strange is. And so the first thing that Norrell tries, of course, is to find him by magic, and he can't. Which means, does that mean that he, like, is this a similar instance of when Strange couldn't find Arabella, right? He does, like, the quadrant thing of, like, you know, oh, she's not in England, Wales, Scotland, or, you know, wherever.
Yeah, maybe.
Or
is he sort of like, cloaking himself somehow?
Well, that's what I was wondering, because, like, the difference is that, like, when he does that with Arabella, she's in Faerie already, right? Like, she's, like, at least in the woods or whatever, or, like, on the way in some interstitial place between, like, the real world and Faerie. And that's why he can't find her in any of the four realms or the four kingdoms of the UK or whatever. Is there four? I guess. Does he say? There's four quadrants. What is he? He doesn't name the fourth, does he? He just says England, Wales, Scotland, and then like he just kind of like points to the fourth, but never like says anything. I think.
Yeah, I don't know.
Like, what's the other one represent? Maybe Ireland.
Is Ireland in the control of the UK at this time? I don't know enough about my.
Well, or maybe it's just like, or the rest of the world, right? Like, isn't that how Great Britain like sees
everything
else? and like the rest of the, you know, empire,
right,
or whatever.
Right. Well, she's not on this tiny island. She could be anywhere. Like, I don't know what you want to do once we're out of this boundary.
I mean, also the fact that she's only been missing for a few hours. So it's not like she would, unless whisked away by magic.
Right, right.
Which they don't really consider, right? Which is kind of funny that they don't consider that, actually. Anyway, all that to say, like, Strange isn't in, like, a fairy realm.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got to be that he's, like, cloaking or hiding himself magically somehow, I would think.
Yeah. That's how I would take it, too. Because I think Norrell probably would think to look on the continent or outside of, you know, the normal sort of British area. So, like, I would guess that Strange is hiding himself somehow. Yeah. Right.
So, anyway, somehow they do get word of him being in Venice. Right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
How is... Do you remember how that happens? I don't remember.
Well, they go to Drawlight, right?
Well, but they send him to Venice. So they already know.
But
right?
Drawlight knows that he's heard rumors that Strange is in Venice.
Oh, Drawlight's the one who actually tells
them. I think so. Like, even from jail, he's heard these rumors.
It's his little birds.
Right.
Told him.
Right.
Which is kind of funny because he does
kind of
have that look.
Yeah, he's kind of Ferris-like in some ways, yeah. Way less competent than Ferris, but, you know.
Oh, for sure. But so here's the thing, right? Like, so it's like, oh man, we can't find him by magic. Oh, I have an idea. Let's send Drawlight. Like, the most untrustworthy and, like, sycophantic you know,
yeah,
incompetent guy that they know.
Right.
Like,
we'll turn as soon as he gets caught. Yeah.
We'll find out from Drawlight where he is and then, like, send Henry Pohl or, like, someone who's actually, like,
sure,
a competent, like, person.
Childermass.
Or Childermass. Or some, yeah, yeah, like.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of potential.
Right.
Like, other people you can send than Drawlight.
Sure. Yeah, but I guess it kind of boils down to what they expect to happen, because it's also like, is Drawlight expendable? Like, if Strange is unhinged and dangerous, maybe it's like, send Drawlight, you know? Like, he's not gonna be somebody who we might actually, like, miss if something happens.
If they kill Drawlight. I mean, I could understand that, like, when you actually, like, know where Strange is and are, like, all right, the first one to approach. But, like,
sure,
they just sort of send him on his own.
Right, right.
Like, everyone's else, like, we're going to stay here and send Drawlight. I don't know. It's just kind of a weird decision in my view.
Sure, sure.
So, yeah, I don't know why they picked Drawlight. It's kind of weird.
Sure.
But, I mean, he's successful. Like, he finds him.
Sure.
And, but, you know.
Yeah.
He also gets drawn into the black, you know, maelstrom of magic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I mean, maybe that's vindication. Maybe that's, like, they made a good decision not going. Like, Henry Pohl, you know, had he gone, would have gotten the, you know, vortex treatment.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, maybe that's the smart reason for sending Drawlight.
Sure. Yeah, and I mean, let's give him his due. Like, the rest of them don't seem to know where Strange is, whereas Drawlight, like, even from his prison cell, has heard these.
Sure.
So, like, he is tapped into a network that the others don't seem to have access to. So, you know, bumbling as he is, there might be certain things that he is actually uniquely sort of valuable for.
Yeah. All right. So we kind of skip around a little bit, because before that is Jonathan's meeting with the gentleman,
mm-hmm,
right? Before the whole vortex thing.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, like, another kind of funny moment, right? So he summons him, and then, like, the gentleman's surprised that he can see him
and
interact with him.
Yeah, there's a lot of really funny gentleman stuff in this episode. I kept, like, laughing at his little surprises of, like, kind of realizing that moment when he realizes Jonathan can see him.
Yeah.
And, like, when he said, like, when he asked for snuff and when, what? You know, like, that little, that surprise
when did I ask?
What is this conversation that we're having?
Yeah. Well, and also that, like, one, that's dangerous, asking a fairy to give you something.
Mm-hmm.
But also the gentleman doesn't do it. Like, he doesn't take him up on the offer,
mm-hmm,
right? Which is also kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, like, I guess just chalking that up to his confusion or whatever. Like,
right.
He seems to be so sort of put off by the fact that Strange can see and request things of him that he fails to take advantage of the request,
mm-hmm,
itself. As much as he's willing to sort of, like, bamboozle other people, including Strange.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't, like, the more, this, like, straightforward requests for snuff, he doesn't go for that. Which is kind of funny.
Yeah. Yeah, they're kind of equally sort of puzzled and bemused by each other and everything. And that's just, like, a great scene of then
Strange is at least like kind of off his guard a bit, right? Sure. Like he's kind of like,
well, yeah, it takes him a few minutes to even catch on to like what's happening. Yeah.
Like somewhere between inebriated and enchanted. Mm-hmm. Like it's not entirely clear what Strange's state of mind is. Mm-hmm. And the gentleman is, yeah, just, I mean, it's pure shock, it seems like. And shock that becomes sort of amusement with the situation and not, like, maybe that's what makes him hesitate mm-hmm. and be unsure of what to actually do.
Yeah, and I think, like, as much as we get the gentleman's power in this episode, you're still, like, getting little glimpses into weak spots in his armor and the fact that, like, Jonathan Ken has figured out how to summon him. And now he's figured out how to summon him and talk to him. And now he can kind of command him when to leave and what to do and all these sorts of things. So, you know, I think it's a bit, seeing the gentleman sort of on the back foot is just kind of inherently funny because you're so used to him being arrogant and seeming like setting himself up as all powerful, all knowing, king of everything, you know? And then, so then again, to have it be that, no, if you kind of figure out the right combination of elements, you can boss him around. You know, which Jonathan hasn't quite figured all that out, hasn't figured out the mechanics of that quite yet. And maybe like when it comes to raw magical power, the gentleman is more powerful. But again, there's still these little moments of, I don't know, weakness that we get glimpses of.
And what's interesting is you get the guardedness too of like kind of how he says things and how he interacts with Strange, like, because it's funny because I think, you know, there's that sense when we see Norrell with the gentleman at first kind of knowing the dangerousness and the tricksiness, I guess, of fairies, that Norrell is very sort of guarded and of course fails even in his guardedness to properly sort of protect himself and Lady Pole from the effects of the magic. I see the gentleman is sort of that way with Strange. And not only, I mean, so there's the, you know, not offering him snuff when he has the chance to maybe take advantage of him, but also like in the ways that he sort of references his inability to bring Arabella back from the dead. Well, I cannot bring Arabella back from the dead. Which Strange assumes is, you know, because she's been dead too long. Like, and he asks leading questions like,
right,
that are meant to, you know, put him in that frame of mind of like, well, how long has she been dead?
Right.
You know, oh, it's whatever. Well, I can't bring her back from the dead.
Right.
But the reason he can't bring her back from the dead is because she isn't dead. Right. It's not because, like, she's been dead too long. Right.
And, like, I didn't write down every line, but I suspect if you went back and it would be that he never outright lies. He tells those, he gives those misleading questions and those half-truths of, you know, and how long has she been dead? And oh, and is her body buried? And you know, like all these things. And then he says, I can't bring her back. And you are sort of, you know, Jonathan's encouraged to make the leap to concluding that he waited too long. He missed his chance.
Right. Yeah, no, the second time through when I watched it, I was very... I watched that scene very closely to try to see what he said. And yeah, I mean, it's quite clear that he's using guarded words and making sure that he doesn't lie outright, but it's all misdirection and, you know, misconception. Mm-hmm. So what, anything else about that sort of scene where he's, so it goes from there. I'm trying to remember, and I didn't take down as good a notes as I should have, but
Well, I think the gentleman, he slips and mentions something about the last time that he, did this, that like it, and maybe
oh,
even
right.
says like in the case of your the other magician, blah blah blah, and kind of gives himself away a little bit. So then it becomes about who was the last magician you dealt with?
Right,
Go
right.
away and bring me a token of, what you gave to him or what you took from him. That's what it is. Like, bring me the thing that you kind of traded him for. And then, he blows out the candle. The gentleman's instantly gone, but there's the little box on the floor.
Which again, so sort of shows the power that Strange has over him. Right? Because the gentleman doesn't want to give it to him. And even says, like, he can't give it to him.
Which is a lie.
Which is a lie. Well, or is it? Is it a lie? Because in a way, Strange compels him. Like, maybe he doesn't give it to him. I mean, he.
It's a technicality or something.
Right. Like, maybe it's a difference between the willingness, the willing giving of it to, or the compulsion to have it appear.
And I love the effect of how that happens instantaneously of he blows out the candle, the gentleman's gone, and the box is on the floor all in the same moment. Like, that's just like a really clever way of kind of instantaneously, I don't know, that just has a it creates a very magical sort of effect.
So then Strange follows him.
He downs like the rest of his mouse potion
Right.
to get some extra mad juices going, and then like stumbles through the mirror and, all the way to Lost Hope, following like the pull of the finger,
Right.
it's kind of like a divining rod for him or something.
Pull of the
The
finger.
pull of the finger, that don't use that title.
No. Yeah, so he gets there and first sees Steven. Or rather, I think Steven sees him first, actually, isn't it? And then sees Lady Pole, and then, of course, sees Arabella dancing. Steven and Emma recognize him, but Arabella doesn't.
She is sort of completely
Enchanted.
enchanted. Whereas, yes, Stephen and Emma, I guess, having that one foot in the human realm, I guess, keeps them somewhat free. That keeps their minds a little bit free.
Yeah, which again, so I keep going back to this thought of like how is it that Steven is able to sort of bargain away Arabella, but the others are not like in that same boat? Like what is the difference? I'm still not sure that I'm clear on like why there's a difference there, like why Arabella wouldn't have the same sort of memory. And I mean, I guess for Emma, it's because it was like the bargain was for half her life, right? So there's still the sense of like she lives half her life, her waking hours anyway. And then, her sleeping hours, she's in Lost Hope. Steven's a little more nebulous. Like, what did he trade exactly? Like, because we talked about that before. It was like his servantness that really like acquiesced to the gentleman's request, right? Like, so maybe that's it. Like, maybe that's the key then, is that like, as a servant, like he serves the gentleman along with like his sort of like regular servant job. I don't know. It's just that thing of like a weird, like, but then somehow Jonathan, by relinquishing or by accepting the Moss Oak Arabella as his wife, like he somehow relinquishes title to the real Arabella. And that means that the gentleman can take her, I guess. I'm still not entirely clear why that gives him like 100% full time enchantment rights to her.
Well, and yeah, it's also not entirely clear sort of what the physical relationship between these realms are, because like if it was just Arabella and Emma, I would say, well, Arabella's been physically taken to Fairy. Like, she didn't die. She, you know, got in a cart and was somehow transported there and is sort of there all the time, like you said. Whereas Emma seems, she goes there in her sleep and in her dreams. Now, I presume she stays in her bed while she does this. Like, seems like it's her mind or her soul that are going dancing at night while she's sleeping. And we, I think we get shots of her like waking up, like as if she's like, she's not sleepwalking to Fairy, I don't think. Stephen is the, like the complicator there, because I don't know.
He seems to go in and out. He
seems to go both. Like, there's times where we get him waking up from, like even in this episode, we get him waking up on the ground, like when they're just on their way to Vinculus's tree. And so it seems like, okay, he was there in his sleep. But then there's other times where it seems like he does physically go through a portal and go there. And so he's the one that I think makes this hard to figure out, like, because he seems to have elements of both, or he doesn't follow the rules that the others seem to have to follow. Like, cause I'm thinking like, does your, either your like physical proximity or your length of time there determine like how completely enchanted you are? But I do think it's Steven that makes that sort of hard to define.
Right.
So yeah, I don't know that we really get a clean answer to that.
Yeah, and maybe that's my problem, is I'm just looking for something that doesn't exist. Or like Norrell, I just can't find it.
So yeah. Well, but in any case, Arabella doesn't recognize him. And even if she did, they're all sort of sent away by the gentleman who cancels his party to deal with this intruder and sends like a lot of leaves and powerful vortexy smoke towards him.
Yeah.
And then sort of collapses in Stephen's arms and, you know, kind of explains how, like, you know, it took everything he had, but he's dealt him such a blow. Like, oh, thank you, Stephen. Like, we've done good work today. Thanks for your support. And Stephen, of course, is not happy about this development, but can't really do anything about it as usual.
Yeah. Which is interesting. Like, Does that show how powerful Strange has become then at this point that it took so much? Because, like, isn't the whole, like, thing about Fairy is that, like, he's supposed to be, like, the super magical, powerful being, mm-hmm. right? Like, even in the way that they talk about the Raven King as having this, like, fairy servant, it's sort of implied that he's, like, this sort of, like, never-ending source of magic and ability. So the fact that he does sort of collapse seems significant.
Yeah.
Even more significant than just, than Jonathan merely, like, I mean, not, I don't mean merely because, like, no one else has been able to do it, but, like, the fact that Jonathan is able to sort of, like, penetrate into Lost Hope at all seems pretty significant. And then how much energy it takes for the gentleman to sort of, I mean, because at first the implication is that he kills him, right? Like, but that's not what happens. Jonathan goes back to, well, I mean, he's like this, creates this like vortexy magic of his own, right? Like in Venice.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, like, I don't know what all the leaves are for, but, like, they just kind of, like, banish him from Lost Hope. He doesn't even, like, actually destroy him or defeat him.
Right.
At least, like, for good in any way. Right. It's just kind of, like, get out of my house. And he sends him back, I guess, to Venice.
Right. Well, with the Black Tower, the vortex in Venice is the gentleman's doing, though, right? Jonathan's, yes, yeah. Yeah, that's the, he says, like, Jonathan says that he's stuck there. Wherever he goes, this Black Tower goes with him.
Okay, maybe I misunderstood exactly sort of the nature of that. Because I thought the whole thing with Drawlight was that it was Jonathan drawing him sort of into the vortex.
Well, it is, but only because he can't leave it. Because he says that he's, like, he's imprisoned in it, basically.
Gotcha.
So
yeah, maybe I...
Yeah, and then I think he does seek out Drawlight. He chases Drawlight around the city and sucks him into it and gives him a good spook. And then kind of sends him off with his messages and everything. But the Black Tower is the gentleman's sort of doing. That's the,
gotcha.
That's the blow that he dealt him. But that doesn't mean Jonathan can't use it to scare his enemies. You know?
Sure. Yeah, so that's kind of where we leave off then, right, with Strange and Drawlight, and I guess the Graysteels sort of escape with everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's the last bit of sort of sending, of the Ravens going through the King's Roads, right, to...
Mm-hmm.
Norrell's house, and that's kind of a cool little effect of, like, the beak,
right, poking through the mirror. Yeah, yeah.
And that, you know, before the flood
mm-hmm.
of Raven sort of comes all the way through.
Yeah. Yeah, and I like Lascelles, the fact that Lascelles has managed to make it this far into the kind of still, like, does Lascelles even really believe what's going on? Like the way kind of Norrell says, like, haven't you listened to anything that I've ever told you? Like, I could see Lascelles being somebody who lives in a world of magicians and still doesn't really believe in magic. Like, sure. Just the whole idea of the mirrors and the fairies and all this is just laughable. Like, he just kind of poo-poos it and everything.
Yeah.
And like, it's kind of impressive, but he's made it to the final episode without really understanding what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So, yeah. All right. So, you mentioned Steven and Vinculus, sort of Steven waking up on the shore, mm-hmm. isn't quite right. The bank, I guess.
The bog, whatever yeah. he's on. Yeah.
On the way to Vinculus's tree. So the thing the sort of just in the last couple minutes here that we have, the couple things that we learn. One is that we've heard Vinculus sort of refer to his book before, and we find out what that is. It's his skin.
Mm-hmm.
It's the writing of the book. The book is literally written on his body,
mm-hmm.
in, you know, sort of tattoo ink.
Mm-hmm. Right. And his father was, for some reason, the keeper of the book, and then ate the book in a drinking game, and then gave birth, he and his wife.
As one does.
Yeah. And then, what does he say, like, 3 years later, I was born. Like, so it's not like this is tattoos or something he's acquired later in life. Like, literally since he was born, Vinculus has been the book in human form, you know, kind of the personal vessel of the Raven King's message.
Sure. Yeah, and so so Vinculus is kind of like showing Steven about who he is and you know where he's going. He takes him to this tree,
mm-hmm.
where the gentleman sort of appears as well.
Right. And we've seen this tree before.
Yeah.
Right. Isn't this where Childermas has his vision when he's when he's sort of shot by Lady Pole and has that brief kind of vision of the tree and the raven, the kind of bullet, as the bullet comes out, it kind of flies like the raven out of the wound. So anyway.
Yeah.
Yes. So yeah, Vinculus has an appointment with his tree.
Which, long story short, the gentleman uses to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least temporarily incapacitate him. But we won't know which of those things until the next
episode. Right.
Yeah, and so there's this continued, and I guess sort of growing, although it's very slow developing, you know, sense of Steven having some kind of unnamed destiny. And I don't know how deep to go with that, but anyway, kind of this idea that, you know, this is important, this means something.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think there's like a hint of this in the book, but my memory is that this speech about our meaning is written on our skin is something a lot stronger in the show, and which I really like. Like, I love this little speech about, you know, what your skin, you know, for Steven, what his skin means. You know, his skin means that people can strike him and without consequences. And it doesn't matter how many books he reads, how many languages he masters, how diligently he works. He says, I'll never be anything but a curiosity. And Vinculus is, my skin means the opposite of yours. Which is, I kind of like, there's a little double entendre there of his skin means the opposite because he's white. So his skin mm-hmm. does not literally mean the same thing as Stephen's, but also his skin is the book. And the book says that Stephen has a purpose and means something right. and has a destiny, you know? So it reverses the situation that Stephen thinks is inherent in his status. Like the thing that his, you know, the way of life that he can never overcome, Vinculus kind of says, well, my book says differently. So yeah, there's just a lot of nice little layers there that I feel like my memory is that when I saw the show for the first time, that was new to me. They hadn't quite spelled it out in those terms before. And I really like that addition.
Sure.
But we end the episode with seemingly Vinculus is dead. The gentleman, when he says, I'm very hard to kill. Oh, it looks like nothing could be easier.
Right.
And, you know.
Let's see about
that. Yeah. And, so it ends with, you know, the gentleman sort of with his arm around Stephen, and Stephen increasingly in despair. Like, all of these people who are promising him deliverance and all these things are being, they're disappointing him. You know,
sure.
You know, Jonathan and Segundus and Vinculus and all these guys who say they can rescue him, they're not able to do anything.
All right. So we'll have to have our discussion on the last episode next week, though. That's kind of where we're left with. On to smile time.
Mm-hmm. Smile time. Sounds so cheerful. It is. I think you have some production notes to start us off.
I do have a few. So the episode was written by Ben Edlin, based on a short story by Whedon and Edlin together. We'll kind of get into the premise and stuff later, but wanted to at least bring up this episode was nominated for a Hugo for short form presentation, which we've brought up before in previous shows. And in fact, this episode lost to BSG, the episode 33. Mm. So,
that's a real apples and oranges pairing, you know? Like,
it is.
It's hard to imagine having to compare them and qualify one against the other, you know?
Sure. And I mean, so the other, to throw out the other competition. Yeah. Is that we've talked about this particular year, which was 2005, before, at least that's the year the award was for episodes, you know,
mm-hmm.
in the previous season. It was also up against Buffy Chosen, the final, the last episode of season 7,
mm-hmm.
As well as two Firefly episodes, Heart of Gold and The Message. So, you know, lots of competition.
Mm-hmm.
Not just even in general, but specifically from other
competition shows. Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, we can argue the merits of all of those, but even among those, I mean, there's still quite a variation
mm-hmm.
In theme and presentation and all that. Yeah. Although I would say, I mean, obviously there's sort of the standard Whedon humor in each of those in various moments, but Chosen, Heart of Gold, and The Message are all pretty heavy episodes
mm-hmm.
of those shows. With, you know, like people dying and some serious themes going on.
Yeah.
Even more so than like other examples within
mm-hmm.
some, you know, those series, I think. Whereas this is, I don't mean to imply that there's no heavy themes that we could suss out, and certainly we'll do our best to try, but like, it's certainly the more whimsical
for sure.
of
yeah.
all of yeah. these other episodes. So
yeah, this is the only like good time among, I mean, Angel's not having a good time, but for everybody else.
Sure.
For the audience, sure. certainly, and everybody else at Angel's expense. This is like the only one of those episodes you would really qualify as fun. Yeah, the others are all pretty on the serious side of things.
Yeah. Angel Magazine took a poll kind of after the show had run its course. And this episode came out as the second best episode in that poll. Other outlets have really lifted it up. MSNBC in their sort of, for that year, their kind of end of year wrap up, kind of gave it a tongue in cheek best appearance by a guest puppet award. The story has been adapted into comics. I have here, you guys can't see it who are listening, but Kat can see. I have my little IDW Angel adaptation. Apparently it was like 3 or 4 episodes, and then, you know, later collected into a hardcover collection. Adapted by Scott Tipton, based on the script by Ben Edlund. Popular enough that there also then was later a Spike comic featuring, so it's actually the same show, but like it was like something where like, I haven't read the Spike version. It's called Shadow Puppets. Where like it's Smile Time, but it's like big in it's like the Seinfeld episode where it's like big in Japan, and okay. So like Spike turns into a puppet in Japan because of this show or whatever.
Okay, so they move on to a different crowd.
Yeah,
okay.
so it's like the same show but like syndicated elsewhere.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
I've not read it, but it just that. Kind of makes me want to read it, the description. And then in Angel After the Fall, which we'll get to kind of when we do our end of series wrap up, After the Fall is kind of it's the comic continuation of the story in the same way that Buffy season 8 is for Buffy. There is sort of an arc within there where they sort of revisit Angel becoming a puppet for a bit. And I'm not going to give away any more than that, because there's actually a little bit, if I say any more, there's a little bit of a spoiler for later in our own watching season. So I won't even mention anyone else who's sort of involved there, but
okay.
There is some other sort of revisiting of the puppet motif there.
Okay.
One other thing I wanted to mention here, and I don't know, I actually was going to ask you before we started recording and then forgot. Did you notice Framkin, the actor who played him?
No, I didn't.
It's David Fury.
Oh.
So we've seen him with cameos before.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah. Now I kind of do recognize him, yeah.
This is, I think, the biggest cameo that he has. But,
okay.
Yeah, just
right, he sang about the mustard stain.
Yeah.
Right.
And there was one other, like he was like one other scene where he was like a sidekick, or not a sidekick, but like a henchman or something like that at one point.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, this is him though, and he has like his speaking part. As a human puppet, I guess. Where we sort of see him, right? But yeah, anyway. So, those are my production notes.
Okay.
So, high level, what did you think? I know I kind of set it up. I think I even told you before we watched it that like it kind of consistently makes
sure
best of lists and that kind of thing. Yeah, you always hesitate to do that because you don't want to give it too much of a, you know, reputation to live up to.
Maybe. Yeah,
but
yeah.
Just kind of, you know, and we can get into talking about the premise and stuff, but just high level, what did you think? Did you like it? Did you not like it?
Yeah, no, it's adorable and delightful. it's yeah, what's there to complain about?
I admit I would have been surprised if you had said you hated it or something.
I mean, it's something that, like, only, I mean, maybe there are other things out there that I don't know about. And maybe there are other things that have been tried that didn't work to the same level. But it's the, I feel like it's the only thing that the Buffyverse, and I'll include Angel in that, kind of can do, is these sorts of completely out of left field, bizarre, like, let's just completely change the premise for an episode.
Yeah.
And, like, because, like, even something like Doctor Who, which I dearly love, and which does do, like, concept episodes, like, and it does mix up genres, like, let's do Doctor Who is this or that or the other. It's more, I don't know, I don't even know if subtle's the word or high level or more like, it's not that. It's just like the idea that you would just do a musical for a week or do, I don't know, change. Yeah, I mean, I guess this is really the only other thing that really stands up to Once More with Feeling in terms of that complete, I mean, maybe Hush too with the silent episode.
Sure.
I don't know, but even that feels like something like another show could do, like find a reason for the characters to be silent. And there's some level of out of left field that I feel like maybe this and Once More with Feeling are the in their own category somewhere. And so, like, I don't feel like we've had Angel episodes that have quite gone even as far as Hush with the concept driven, like we've had standalones, we've had strong episodes, we've had good concepts, but this just kind of like, let's just break a bunch of rules and do something completely inherently silly that we know is completely silly and that we think the audience is just going to enjoy. And that's not to say it doesn't have things to say or doesn't move the story forward or anything, because clearly it does. But it's just that kind of like, what part of somebody's brain does this come from?
Sure.
And that it works well, like that the puppet is designed to really kind of look like him in a way, like to kind of capture the essence of the frowniness and
the broody.
Yeah. Like, and I guess it makes you realize, like, in a good way, I guess when you can parody something, that's a compliment. Like, it means that there's something iconic to latch onto. Like, there aren't parodies of things that are sort of just fine and mediocre, you know? Like, I feel like for the character of Angel to work as the puppet, you have to get him to the place where he can stand up to that. You know, and I like, maybe, I don't even know that, like, Angel and Buffy the series had that same level. It's more like, okay, after 5 years of Angel the series, we know Angel well enough that we can completely tear him down in this way. And, like, yeah, do him as a puppet and kind of know that we're going to recover and things are going to go back to kind of business as usual next week. And this can just be like the bizarre puppet adventure that we had.
Sure.
I don't know if any of that makes sense, but it's just, there's a reason that every show would never even think to do this or would attempt it. So I'm trying to kind of put my finger on what that is, you know?
Yeah, I'm trying to think too, like if there are even any other episodes that come close, and I agree, like I can't think of any. I mean, even ones that are a little more off the off the normal sort of procedural aspect of what Angel sort of is, or at least started out as. Like, I'm coming to things like the Cordy alternate universe episode, mm-hmm. but that's just kind of like the Wish, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, it's still sort of a monster of the week kind of episode, just
right,
kind of,
right. Alternate universes, anybody yeah. can do those. Like, you know, you can think of other.
And we talked about how, you know, the Harmony episode is, you know, kind of like the Zeppo, right? It's like the Xander mm-hmm. focused episode again, like,
right.
And obviously, like, they do things appropriate to the character. They don't just take the same thing and apply it,
yeah.
but
yeah.
you know, they it's still high concept enough that it's like, mm-hmm. okay, well, what would Harmony do in these situations yeah. and stuff? But
so,
it's still not as whimsical or
right.
or whatever as this kind of.
So, I mean, they're given reasons within, so it's not like they completely lose all sense of the ongoing story or like don't bother to explain why this is happening. But at the same time, I feel like it's a complete disregard or just deciding we don't care about the concept of like suspension of disbelief. Like if anything is going to trigger, like if we you take that concept seriously, which we don't even really have to, that like when you're watching something or reading something, you're at least momentarily sort of in the world of the thing and you're not thinking about yourself or the outside world, you're sort of, you know, in the world of the characters and you know, sucked into the secondary world and that whole thing. I think it's just this attitude of saying, yeah, we don't care about maintaining that, like which goes beyond what those other episodes do, because even like the Zeppo, for all that it's weird and quirky, it's all it is just a reframing. It doesn't like break the rules of the narrative. It just says like, well, we're gonna put the camera over here or something, like, whereas this is like, again, this and Once More of Feeling, I feel like have this attitude of we don't care if what we do in this episode breaks the reality of the story, or what we're going to do it anyway. And it's going to work so well that you're going to go along with it, even if it seems like it shouldn't work.
Sure.
So anyway, there's just a kind of audacity to
maybe Superstar. Just because there's some meta-ness to it,
sure,
that
sure.
that I think could, but even that, I don't feel like it's as ingrained, I think, mm-hmm. as either like what you're saying with Once More with Feeling or this episode mm-hmm. or Smile Time.
Yeah, I mean, like
but
just
that would
kinda
be maybe the only other one that I could think of that comes close.
Yeah. Yeah, just the kind of way it draws attention to itself as
mm-hmm.
as a contrivance, you know, as like,
right.
yeah, this is the musical episode or this is the puppet episode. And we are not attempting to disguise that at all, because there's no way you could do those concepts and try to disguise them at the same time. There would be no point. So,
sure. Well, yeah. And even because, I mean, they still do like the trappings of like Once More with Feeling, like there's a demonic presence,
right. and
that
that's,
was
right.
summoned,
and that's why I said like they do
that,
put in
but
reasons,
but even with that, it's like, okay, but does that explain the completely different title card that we see?
Sure.
And like the opening sequence that's different,
mm-hmm.
like
right,
if those are like, are those you know, diegetic elements of the show or not.
Right.
Like,
right.
And it kind of toys with that.
Right. Right. So there are other episodes that are meta. And there are other episodes that are high concepts, like let's try to do some sort of weird experimental thing. But I think this isn't one of those few that like tries to do both and then completely pushes it past the point where you think they would go. Yeah, because I could even see like a spin-off comic of Angel as puppets, but the idea that you would do it in the show itself is just hilarious. And I think mostly works because the puppet looks so good. Sure. I don't think it would work with kind of a generic Muppet. Like, it's the fact that it's Angel as the puppet is like, that's the concept. That's what's really like great and memorable about this.
And so they did. So, you know, okay. So if we're asking the question, like, okay, why even like do this? what's the Pam quote from The Office? Like, why did that come into your brain?
Right.
Right. Like,
yeah.
apparently they had this idea back in season 4 sometime, of like, we want to do just like an evil Sesame Street show.
Hmm.
I think meaning like as the monster of the week. So right, kind of the idea right. for like a smile time at, but like that doesn't necessarily encompass like turning Angel into
that's that missing X factor. Yeah.
And that particular piece of it was Whedon's idea. And, you know, and I'm doing a little crit faking here based on just what I've read, but I assume that like once that happened, then that sort of dictates, right? Like they talk about like, you know, breaking the plot, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's where the plot broke and they were able to like figure out like, okay, what are the beats that
right.
we want
right.
to hit here?
Right. And that's what sets it apart from, I think if it had been Evil Sesame Street as the concept, then it would be like a memorable, weird episode. But it's Angel as the puppet that puts it into some other right. realm, right. you know. So, yeah, thank goodness for Whedon's strange brain.
And so just one other comment there, because you talk about the puppets being so good. And they hired puppeteers from the Jim Henson
Company. Right, right.
So...
Right, you know, and they have that Sesame Street and Muppet, like, I don't know anything about puppet design to know what distinguishes a Jim Henson Muppet from something else, but...
Right, but you
but
know
it's
it.
Clearly
you know it
Jim,
when you see
yes,
it.
It's, they're from the same family of puppet, yeah.
Yeah, and I love that they just have a puppet that just, like, honks at you.
Yeah.
Like, that's the, you know, that's the mode of communication. Like, even
Horatio
in, like...
Horatio Hornblower, right? Isn't that his name?
Yeah. Yeah. Like even in the like they're having like a serious, you know, council
right.
of like the puppets, like how do we, you know, kill the bat, you know, how do we kill the guy that's trying to stop us, and like just honks
yeah.
at you.
Yeah. Well, and so let's kind of finish talking about like the premise and the puppets themselves and the kids and everything, since we're kind of on the topic. You know, the seed of evil Sesame Street is still in there with the kind of awful, like, inappropriate behavior of the puppets. And the whole thing is, like, swigging the whiskey and talking about murder and, you know,
and that opening scene.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
There's a very...
Yeah.
Molesting
kind of
feel like come over and
right.
touch it.
Right, you should never break a promise. She's gone, so yes, come over here and touch me. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Super, super creepy. And creepy kid with a creepy smile on his face. That's definitely.
Oh yeah, like, and the like twisted.
Yeah,
like
he looks like his
body and like
his arm is sort of dislocated, like. You know, the kid's probably double jointed or something. The way he's able to like get his arm behind his head and everything.
Yeah, the casting for that was just like, yeah, can you put your arm out of socket?
Right, like, we need a double-jointed kid. And then put plaster a really evil, soulless smile on your face. So, and it's kind of fun throughout, like, especially as it goes on and heads towards the climax with all the, like, the threats between Angel and the puppets. Like, you know, the whole, like, I'm going to send you to hell and all that kind of thing is just funny. If you're going to do evil puppets, you have to make them, like, really, really bad.
Sure.
Yeah. So anything else about them? And, I mean, I think...
I mean,
when it comes down to it, the plot is pretty straightforward. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what I was just going to say. Like, the plot's... Like, okay, there's, like, this, you know, thing animating the puppets or whatever, and, like, they're...
Yeah.
Yeah, they're feeding on the kids who watch them.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Like,
sure. Yeah, seems pretty standard.
And then, like, the fact that they're, you know, oh, the puppets are controlling the people. Oh, okay.
Right. Yeah, that's a good moment of Frampkin's hole in the back of his... back, you know.
What about Sid the dummy?
Sure. Did not work as well as this episode,
yeah.
Let me tell you. Yeah, that's an example of how this can go wrong. God, I haven't seen that episode in forever. I forget why I hated it, but I remember hating it.
It's not a great episode.
No.
Well, I mean, part of it's just, I don't know. I don't know that, well, let's not revisit that episode and dissect it. Let's turn back to this one, which is much more fun.
Yeah.
I don't even know that we need to spend a ton of time on the plot itself. I mean, it's more the interactions with Angel and the other members of the team.
Yeah.
That are kind of the fun
and
more interesting parts, I think.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. I mean, primarily, so like, yeah, he goes to the TV station, he gets blasted, he wakes up, he's a puppet, you know. Typical day. And I like that he goes through a door.
As one does.
And I like that he goes through a locked door marked don't. Like.
Right.
It's just funny. yeah. And so I guess primarily in terms of interactions with the team, it's the just having them try not to laugh at him. You know, and everybody kind of sniggering and smirking behind their hands.
And his, like, increasingly furrowed brow.
Yes.
Like.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I like, too, that they come up with, like, a sort of explanation for why he gets so angry. And so, I mean, not that, like, Angel doesn't already get pretty darn angry at, you know, people for the, you know, just kind of.
Right.
Whatever.
Right.
Right.
But all his emotions are heightened here.
But it's
like,
because you're a puppet now, you, like, all your emotions come out, you know, puppet-like.
Right.
Which are,
right,
you
exaggerated.
Know, because puppets are for kids, yeah, they're exaggerated and overwrought and, like, you're more broody and more irritable than maybe.
Right.
You would be.
Right.
You know,
but he's
otherwise.
Also thrilled when Smile Time comes on. And later on, he, when they realize how they're going to, you know, when they figure out the whole secret of the puppet demons, he, you know, hugs them and says how much he loves them. And, you know, like all of his, it's like there's a line in Peter Pan about fairies, you know, the Tinkerbell size fairies, not like the gentlemen.
Sure.
And how they're so small, they only have room for one emotion at a time. So, like, if Tinkerbell is in a jealous rage, she's gonna, like, be
like,
in a jealous rage
yeah.
because there's no room for anything else. whatever she feels is sort of all encompassing. So it kind of reminded me of that. Like, he's so little that he has only, you know, room for one thing. So yeah, that's pretty funny. Yeah, I mean, it's hard. The only thing that's hard about this is that it's a funny episode, and those are sometimes harder to talk about. Because right. It's sort of like a series of comedic scenes, you know, like, you know, the others kind of laughing at him and, you know, kind of him wanting to hide from everybody, obviously, like Angel being the sort of proud person that he like is.
Going under the desk to like, hide from Nina.
Yeah, and doesn't, you know, want all eyes on him and everything. Of course, when Spike sees him, that draws him out of his shell. And, you know, it turns into this big brawl in the hallway that results in everybody getting to see Angel. Right. Yeah, and just, like, I don't know, just the pure imagery of having Spike pummeled by a little Muppet. And then Angel walking down the hallway. I love that shot when it's him walking, like, one foot. It, like, most of the time he's, like, behind the desk, but that's the one shot where it's, like, they have a marionette. And he kind yeah. of, and you see, like, his legs and, you know, the way he kind of shuffles down the hallway. Yep. It's just hysterical. I don't have anything insightful to say about it other than that.
Yeah,
it's funny. Maybe, it's just fun to make fun of Angel, I think, is really the point of this episode. Is, yeah, he's reached that level where, you know, we can parody him and still kind of, you know, not destroy the character in the process.
Yeah. And maybe we don't need to go a long time, not because, you know, it's an episode not worthy of discussion, but just, yeah, like you said, like, it's hard to dissect comedy, like, sometimes. Like,
right, like, let's explain why the jokes are funny. Like, you know.
Yeah.
Or just list favorite scenes, which I think we could keep doing, but again, is that really telling us anything about why we like it?
Were you surprised to see Nina come back?
Well, I want to get into the relationship. So, yes, I was. I think I said when she had her episode that on the one hand, I could see her coming back, but on the other hand, I didn't really expect it just because Angel's sure. sort of tertiary love interests don't tend to come back. It's very often. That's not really
true.
A thing yeah. that happens. So yes, I was surprised. So yeah, I mean, that's a thing. I'll be interested to see if she keeps coming back. I mean, I guess that's the real question is, you know, like, I see the purpose that she serves in this episode as we need a potential love interest for Angel to kind of feel insecure about. So it has to be someone we've met before and, you know, might root for and all that sort of thing. So I guess my question beyond this episode is, does she still have a role to play after this episode is over? You know, because this, I mean, so we named the episode after the self-esteem song. And, like, that seems like from, I guess, both the Angel and West points of view, it is very much an episode about their self-esteem in their relationships and kind of finding self-worth at the lowest point, you know? And, like, I mean, Angel's insecurities have nothing to do with being a puppet, but it certainly didn't help. And he becomes this sort of manifestation of all of his fears, like this weird little, you know, thing that, you know, what woman or person would be interested in him if he's such a bizarre creature. And it's like, you know, in this episode, that's kind of literally true. You know. So, yeah, that's sort of my question is, like, can that be a recurring relationship in the show? I don't know. I mean, it certainly could, but will it?
Right. Sure.
Yeah, I don't know. Is there anything else about the Angel-Nina dynamic that I should be sort of paying attention to, do you think? I mean, there's always the kind of vampire-werewolf sort of thing.
Sure.
Right,
this, like, what's the Underworld movies, right?
Sure.
Like, isn't that the whole thing? Like,
right.
Vampires versus lycanthropes.
Well, and there's like, yeah, no matter which universe, it always seems like there's an antipathy between the two for whatever reason. I don't know what that
sure.
stems from, but like
Dracula meets the Wolfman kind of
something.
Thing. Like,
yeah, like there, yeah, right. There's
universal.
there's some tradition that they aren't necessarily, even though they're both kind of dark creatures and
of the
night.
Well, that's even, that's in Dracula, right? Like, isn't that...
Well, and Dracula's kind of both at times. So, like...
Well, yeah, no, but I mean, like, the children of the night are the wolves.
Right,
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 like,
right. So...
Which maybe aren't werewolves per se, but who's to say they're not?
Right, right. And so, but even though they have sort of things in common, I feel like there is a lot of times the assumption that they don't get along.
Yeah.
So
yeah, for sure.
That's kind of an interesting, they haven't really made that into a thing yet in this. Like, I don't get the sense that there's any reason why Angel and Nina shouldn't like each other, but that
right.
could be an interesting sort of thing down the road that, you know, that you might want to, they might want to incorporate if they decide to kind of keep the relationship going into future episodes. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, other than the sort of, like, here where, as a werewolf, she attacks him. But that's, like, just part of the nature of her werewolfness.
Right,
right? Like,
right.
she would attack anyone.
Right, right.
It's not because he's a vampire.
Right. Yes. And in a way, it again, makes them more similar than anything else. They both are, you know, kind of monstrous in some sense, but also neither of them are evil. You know, they both have one foot in humanity and have their consciences and their souls, and, you know, neither of them are, you know, killers, or not anymore. So, but there is that kind of, they both have this darkness within them. They both could be dangerous. And they both kind of have to wrestle with what that means. So they have a lot in common, I think. So, yeah.
As long as Angel doesn't become too happy.
Right, which he's concerned about. Wes doesn't seem to think that's likely, which kind of makes me laugh. Like Angel,
which is,
how likely are you ever to be perfectly happy again? Let's get real.
Although going back to the puppet thing, given the sort of like emotion
sure
enhancement, like I wonder, I mean, we don't, I'm only just thinking of this now, but like we don't really get that as a potential fear or anything, but
right, but in hindsight, yeah,
yeah,
that is, and puppet and jealous. What would that be like?
Right?
Could he bite anybody with his little felt fangs?
I mean, yeah, you don't get the sense that he's really hurting
right.
people that much, right?
Right.
In that scene where him and Spike fight, I did see a quote from James Marsters that, like, they had to shoot that a number of times because he kept laughing, just, like, from the... Which, I mean, it is a ridiculous thing.
Yeah.
But just that it there were maybe some things that made that had a particular difficulties in this episode because of that reason.
Yeah.
Oh, I should also say, so I mentioned it was written by Ben Edlund. It was also directed by him as well, which I feel like for an episode like this, you almost have to have that, right? Like,
right.
It would be hard to have it directed by someone who didn't also write it.
You want control over what the vision, you know, like when you write something, it's, yeah, good to have in mind how you're going to stage it and everything. So I'm pleasantly surprised to see Nina. Hopefully we see more of her.
Sure. I won't say one way or the other, but.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that is funny when he's going on about how he's grown and he's more aware of the world around him, and she, attacks him from behind and rips out his stuffing.
And then, like, the little, like, stitch scars.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, he has, like, a slash across his face and, yes, kind of stitches himself back together. And struggling, bleeding, stuffing through the hallway, and when Lauren finds him.
right, looking for a tailor.
Right, my little prince. Yeah.
We have a Geppetto.
yeah, there's a bunch of good Lauren moments in here. I also like his idea about puppet cancer. I don't have puppet cancer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. You know what we kind of skipped over was Gunn. I think we need to talk about
Gunn. Oh, yeah.
For
sure. So, yeah, what about
Gunn? So what the heck is Gunn going to do? Because the senior partners,
they kind of screwed him over a little bit.
So we don't know. Is this an active decision that they're making? Is it that they granted him this knowledge and now they're taking it away? Is it that it's naturally sort of fading and they're just not sort of bothering to renew his contract? Is it that with the conduit gone, that he's lost some sort of, maybe they are not in contact anymore. Maybe they would want to, you know, reinstate his power, but they're out of the loop for some reason. We don't know any of this. Like, we do know that the White Room is empty. And we do know that Eve is gone. And we know that they,
as far as we know,
and we know that they or somebody sucked Lindsay into another dimension. And that's all that we know. So there could be a number of explanations for this. So he has acute flowers for Algernon syndrome. And he's not happy about it. And, is willing to do whatever it takes to get it back. So yeah, he agrees to.
Yeah. What does that mean?
Right. Well, I guess we'll find out because he goes to his shady doctor and, agrees to do basically whatever he wants him to do if he'll give him the permanent upgrade, which right now sounds like legal help, you know, get me out of all the, like, find all these loopholes into all my shady dealings for me and I'll take care of this. But, you know,
maybe they
don't really know yet the full extent of what that means. Or what kind of deals he's involved in. So that is not a great situation for Gunn. But he's pretty much hooked by now on this new role within the group. Isn't really willing to go back to his old life. So he's kind of between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah, a little bit.
He also ends the episode surrounded by puppet limbs and look when he's like draped by the camera with like the other puppet like just torn and strewn about him. It's funny. So yeah, anyway, just wanted to mention that, see where it goes. I'm thinking that's not a good situation. And nobody knows about it is the other thing too. Like, this is never a good idea, is that the others don't realize that he's made this kind of second deal. And so if something were to go wrong, does anybody kind of have context for what's going on? Other than Lorne, who kind of saw him stumble over his words a bit. But I don't know that that's enough to really fully... I don't think it was enough to really tip Lorne off that, like, something is going on. It was sort of just a momentary, you know.
And, like, well, one, Lorne is, of all the group, like, Lorne is probably the most forgiving.
Right.
But then also, like, they've all been up late, busy doing lots of stuff. Like, yes, Gunn is smart and has all this knowledge about, you know, law and languages and, you know, Sinatra songs, but like, or whatever. Who was it? What were the songs that he had?
Was it
Sondheim or something, right? Like, didn't he have like all
like, right, Rodgers and Hammerstein or something. Or Gilbert and Sullivan. Yeah. I think it was Gilbert and Sullivan.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, yeah. Wow, that we took a journey on that.
Just name different composers. I think it was Gilbert and Sullivan.
Yeah, so, like, he has all that stuff, but, like, that doesn't mean he's, like, infallible. Like, and I think, just given all the late nights and stuff, like, the fact that he forgot something for a moment, like, probably no one else even thought about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
yeah, I didn't get the sense that it was anything that Lorne really dwelled on or noticed to any great extent. So yeah, so Gunn is not, if like he's in a vulnerable position, if something goes wrong, you know, nobody really knows what he's done. So yeah. Anyway, let's finish with Wesley and Fred. Who, I have to say, this has been a slow burn for Wesley and Fred.
a little bit.
But for all that, I was a little surprised at how quickly it developed in this episode. I've seen, I guess I've seen Fred starting to think about, like, all right, apparently, as people are telling her, that she has these potentially three different guys interested in her. Although Gunn seems like totally into his new job. Like, we don't
He seems like completely out of...
Totally out of it. But Harmony said something about Gunn, so we'll include him. So I've seen her, I feel like I've definitely noticed her kind of starting to, like, question, is she... Who does she really have feelings for? Who's she gonna choose? You know, if it's Knox, is that really the guy for her? All that sort of thing. But I wasn't necessarily expecting her to sort of declare anything in this episode. So it was sort of like, I didn't realize she'd, I didn't realize she'd made a decision, to the extent that she has in this episode. It wasn't a bad development. It just was kind of took me a little bit by surprise, which is kind of hilarious considering that they've been building this romance for like three or four seasons now or whatever it's been.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. So after Wes's whole like kind of lecture to Angel about not being oblivious and going for it and, you know, all these things. You know, of course, it takes Fred to come in at the end and have to kind of spell out for him what, you know, the signals she's trying to send.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, and like, quite literally.
Yes. Yeah, and I like that, you know, for all Wesley's wisdom when it comes to what Angel should do, everybody's, you know, wiser about each other than they are about themselves. You know, he doesn't really get it himself because, you know, I like that moment when Fred says, you know, about Knox, like, he doesn't make me laugh at all. And Wesley's, oh, I see. You're looking for someone funny. And he turns around like, well, it's not going to be me. Like, you know, I'm not funny enough. Like, you know, it's just, that was a funny moment.
Right.
His disappointment in that realization, like, oh, you want someone funny. All right. Like, not me then, I guess.
Sure. Sort of your moment.
Like, well, foiled again, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, and so, I mean, and then there's Knox, right? Like, there's some rebuffment
mm-hmm.
going on here. I'm not sure what the
proper
term is. Especially of the things of, like, it's like, oh, you know, Fred sends him home, but, like, but also, like, I mean, hey, you know, maybe this is one of those things that would be filmed differently today, or, you know, told differently today mm-hmm. in the world of, you know, there's a lot more scrutiny around, like, corporate relationships and that kind of thing, where, like, yeah, maybe Fred, you shouldn't have ever even been really considering Knox as, like, a potential one, considering he's your immediate subordinate.
Mm-hmm.
But
sure.
And I think that comes out a little bit, where, you know, there is sort of that sense of, like, he works for her, and so maybe it's not entirely appropriate, but
mm-hmm.
I don't get the sense that that's, like, the real reason.
I don't,
that she,
yeah, I didn't really,
like that,
like,
is,
maybe
that
she
is,
would use that as a pretext, but I didn't necessarily get the sense that that's her motivation.
No, her motivation is Wesley. She likes Wesley.
Right.
That's fine.
Right.
But there is that sort of moment, I think, when he's, like, leaving. Like, when Fred and Wesley are watching the show and doing, like, their full spectrum scan or whatever. And Knox is kind of, like, giving that look of, like, okay, is there, I mean, he's a Wolfram and Hardin.
I was going to say, like, he does work for an evil law firm, so you might want to just be a little careful with how you break it to him.
Is there, you know, is Knox scorned, you know, going to be a problem?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would be surprised if it wasn't.
And I suppose we'll see.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, cool. Yeah. So I don't know. I'm sorry. Did you have any other final thoughts or comments?
No, not really. I think we kind of went over everything I wanted to go over. It was a great little episode. So I have seen the angel puppet image before. So I'm glad.
I would be surprised if you
had. I'm glad, like, to have finally got to the thing that it comes from.
I mean, there are a lot of great episodes of Angel, but I feel like even more so than Buffy, which has, like, maybe three or four that people would know.
Right.
This more than anyone.
Right. Stands
maybe
out
not
from
by
the past.
Title,
yeah.
But
yeah.
Certainly, like, of the puppet image.
Yeah.
Would know. And maybe, like, you wouldn't even realize that it was an episode. It's just, oh, I've seen that before, and think it's an animal, mm-hmm. or, you know, like a stuffed creature from the show, mm-hmm. like not necessarily realizing it's actually an episode in the show, but yeah, of like all the Angel episodes, I feel like this is probably the most iconic one that people who've never seen it mm-hmm. would have known about. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Cool. All right.
Well, all right. So next week we'll be back with the final episode of Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell and kind of do our series wrap up of that. And yeah, we'll be back with another episode of Angel. And I guess we'll see, you know, does Dina come back? Does Knox take his revenge? Mm-hmm. Does, you know, Angel's puppetness wear off fully?
In a couple days. I love that it's going to be a couple days, you know.
Right.
And that it finishes with him still in puppet form.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, so we'll see all that next time.
Sounds good. See you then.